The Israel Connection is proudly sponsored by the United Israel Appeal.
This is the Israel Connection on J-Air Community Radio in Melbourne, Australia. Dr. Tzvi Fleischer, the editor of Ajax Australia-Israel Review magazine, wrote a piece that was published over 15 years ago on the subject Israel in the Australian media. This week, I revisit this very subject with Tzvi Fleischer, and in an extensive interview, we take a look at how the media landscape has changed over the last 15 years. I'm delighted to welcome Tzvi Fleischer, the editor of the Australian Israel Review, to the Israel Connection on J-Air Community Radio. It's good to have you on the program.
Hi, David. Good to be here.
Now, you wrote an article, Tzvi, going back a bit, 2005, 15 years ago, which is on the topic that we're going to talk about essentially today, that is Israel and the Australian media. In that article, you said that the Australian media focuses disproportionately on Israel and particularly on the Arab-Israeli conflict. To start things off, can you explain why this is so, that the media deals with the subject of Israel in such a fashion?
I think it's a bit of a mystery to some extent, but it's not exclusively Australia that this is the case, but it's certainly the case. Israel has far more journalists from around the world than its size or significance would warrant otherwise, and that the main thing they want to talk about is the Arab-Israel conflict, Palestinians, etc. They're not interested in Israeli high tech that much, though you're getting more of that lately, or in Israeli society. They're really interested in the Arab-Israel conflict. There's a lot of historical reasons why, and I think this has to do with related to the coverage as well, why people see the Arab-Israel conflict as the center of the problems of the Middle East or even wider, which is, I think, very incorrect, but nonetheless a widely held perspective. And I think a lot of that goes back to the 60s and 70s for a few reasons, which maybe I'll go into later. 15 years ago, it was true, and it's still true, though it's interesting to note that there were more Middle East correspondents from Australia back then. With the changing media landscape, there are less there now. There's more dependence for news from the area on wire services and BBC and other services like that that have correspondents in the region. It is still... Jews are news, they say, but I'm not sure that's the answer here, but I think that it sums up what's going on a little bit.
So in that article that you wrote, you've referred or used a reference to a paper which was written by David Bernstein from the American Jewish Committee. The article that he wrote, Israeli Media, A Guide to Producing Effective Media Critiques, still available, and I'll put out a new link to that because your link in your article is no longer applicable. Sure. That article refers to narrative frames, and it provides a good model for understanding the way the media deals with the subject of Israel. Do you want to explain what these narrative frames are?
Sure. Narrative frames are sort of storylines that shape coverage. They're sort of ways of viewing conflict and the way things work. Bernstein perceptively identified three that are particularly used in the Arab-Israel conflict. They tend to see it as a cycle of violence. That is, that the violence is the reproduction of one side hits back at the other. There's no real one to blame here. If someone uses violence, it must be in reaction to violence on the other side. When that isn't really, I think, an accurate portrayal of what's going on in the Israeli-Palestinian case. The more dangerous one is narrative frame two, the victims versus victimizers. And this one, I think, has gotten worse since I've... in some degree, at least in some circles, since I wrote that paper, which says that you need to identify that, you know, who is the victim and who is the victimizer here. And I think the Israel-Palestinian conflict, particularly the oppressor versus the innocent, who's the more powerful party is the frame we get a lot lately. Of course, Israel is the more powerful party, but that doesn't really tell you a lot about what's going on. I think it's a very small part of the story. What particularly makes that one attractive on the Israel conflict, I think a lot of people are very attracted to the theme. See, the Jews were victims of Nazism, and now they're the victimizers. That one is an irresistible theme to a lot of journalists for a variety of reasons, but it comes up a lot. I think a lot of analysis comes back to that. I think it's a particularly ugly and dangerous one. The third frame is, and I think this has become a little less important in the last 10-15 years, is all negotiations are good, all conflict is bad. Anyone who does something which damages negotiations must be the bad guy. That one's more understandable, but it's a way a lot of the stories you get about Israel are framed, that people, when something happens, they immediately try and a journalist who may not be that much detailed knowledge or very superficial detailed knowledge may try and frame the story in one of those frames. Israel did something that could damage prospects for negotiation, even though it may have very little relevance. Or here, Israel struck back. That's part of the cycle of violence, even though Hamas struck them first. Israel hits Gaza in response to Hamas attacks, etc. And then, of course, the victim versus victimizer one, you see among some of the most nasty stuff, which assumes that nothing Israel do can be basically justified, that the Palestinians are helpless, and therefore any violence by Israel is per se obviously evil or negative or indefensible. Everything in life is, to some extent, seen through frames of this sort, but when you get ignorant journalists with some prejudices coming to the Middle East, you get bad coverage as a result of this.
And when we talk about narrative frame two, victim versus victimizer, the underdog syndrome, does that fall under that frame?
Absolutely. Look, like I said, the underdog syndrome is part of that one. And as I said, it's gotten worse because there's the modern sort of postmodernist intersectionality says, which has become very popular in certain circles and certainly among journalists, many journalists, says essentially you identify in any discussion about two groups or two people, you identify who is the more powerful, who is the less powerful. The powerful person is the only one who has moral agency. They're the only one who anything you can say about them is criticized. Anything the powerless person does, or the less powerful person, they would treat them as powerless, does, is obviously a reaction to the more powerful person. They have no real power. They've been driven to anything nasty they do. They would have no choice but to do anything nasty they do. The only one who can be criticized are the powerful ones. And I think that's applied a lot to the Israel-Palestinian conflict, particularly in the last 10 years. Again, not by everybody, but among some journalists and some analysts. And I think that a lot of Israel's problems come from that underdog syndrome, and it's getting worse, as I said, as a result of sort of postmodern approaches that people are picking up in university and now in the wider society. And it's also intersectionality, which says the Israel-Palestinian conflict is part of global oppression. There was a very interesting quote, don't have it right in front of me at the moment, about a year ago, someone from a far-left group, there was some sort of rally in New York opposing, I think, annexation of Jerusalem, something like that. And somebody from crazy far-left union said something along the lines of, Zionist imperialist Israel must be defeated. What it is, capitalism will be defeated, and all colonialism will be defeated, and socialism will break out, and peace will break out all over the world. A view among some circles in the left that goes back, I think, to the Soviet era, propaganda, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is the most important conflict in the world, and not only that, it's the linchpin of imperialism. It doesn't make any sense, of course, but it's the linchpin of imperialism, the center of all that's bad in the world. And that's not, now most people who are sort of intersectionality don't necessarily go that far, but they absolutely, there's an argument, and they're not allowed to even argue with it, that the Palestinians are the same as American black suffering and women suffering and trans people suffering and anybody else, people of color you can think of, disabled people, all suffering is linked, and the Palestinians are absolutely part of that. Unless you fight for the Palestinians, none of those things can be solved because it's all intersectional and linked.
Yeah, with this,
so that's gotten even worse.
Yeah, with this underdog syndrome, it becomes manifest in the thinking of many politicians. I've heard Adam Bandt quite a few years ago saying, how can the Palestinians properly negotiate with the Israelis because the Israelis are just so much more powerful. So they'll never get a fair deal because they don't have strong enough control or power in order to gain any ascendancy over Israel that will dominate always the situation when they're conducting negotiations. And that fits in with what you were saying, I think.
That's a very classic example, I think, of this argument that the powerless have no agency, the powerful all moral obligation is on the powerful, the powerless have no moral obligations. If they commit terrorism, they have to. If they are racist, they have to be. They've been driven to it. There can be no argument that anything they do is ever wrong or is ever immoral or even counterproductive. You can't say that about them. You can't expect anything from them. The only person you're allowed to criticize is the one you identify as the powerful. And I think Bant is very much in that circle and camp.
Let's try and bring things now, Tzvi, into more our own context in Australia. Now, there are certainly domestic influences within our own Australian media, especially among the public broadcasters and some of our newspapers that exacerbate the problem that we've just been discussing. So perhaps you want to try and, although we get a lot of our feed from overseas, how is all this handled and disseminated by our Australian media?
It's worth sort of breaking it up a bit. If we start with the newspapers, I think things, back in the article in 2005, I looked at sort of the papers, and there were the Murdoch papers back then, and there were the Fairfax papers then, and now the Nine papers, The Age, The Morning Herald, Financial Review. There were also some independent papers. And I got to say, now the media landscape with newspapers has changed immensely in that period. Newspapers are struggling. They've changed a lot. At the time, one of the papers we were most concerned about was the Canberra Times, which was putting out some horrible stuff in the early 2000s. Some stuff that really was anti-Semitic and indefensible. That they really stopped. They're much more responsible and sensible now. They went through a period of being owned by Fairfax and are now at a different part of a different company, but they've changed drastically. The Murdoch papers have more or less stayed the same, but the competition is different. The competition is much sharper. Everything in the newspapers is also, people don't rely on newspapers for their news as much as they used to. Newspapers are trying to do more commentary, more analysis, which can make things more complicated. The Nine papers also, what were then the Fairfax papers, I mean, at the time I wrote that piece, they had Edel Lachlan as their Middle East correspondent. He was really bad. He was really a pro-Palestinian advocate. All of his stories were framed from the Palestinians say this is terrible, horrible thing is happening to them. The stories were basically suggested by, I think, Palestinians or from the Palestinian perspective. And he would have often, his balance was in the 12th paragraph, Israel denies this. That's his balance. Or, an Israeli spokesman denied this. After paragraphs and paragraphs of here's what the Palestinians say, quoting Palestinians and offering his own evidence in support of what the Palestinians say. This was during the Intifada, of course, when there was a lot of violence, and he was backing it and heavily putting the Palestinian view of it. So that isn't true anymore, but the Fairfax papers, of course, don't have a Middle East correspondent anymore. Neither does the Australian, for that matter, for the News Limited papers. They used to, and the papers don't have the money anymore to do that. They're using overseas feeds. Some cases that's better, sometimes it's worse. Then we get down to which overseas feeds are the worst and the best. We get a lot of very nasty stuff sometimes, even in the Murdoch papers from Agence France-Presse, AFP. That's probably the worst of the widely used print sources. Sometimes you get some very nasty biased stuff from them. AP also, all of them can be problematic, though I think the AP or Reuters or whatever, all of them can be problematic, but I think compared to an Edel Lachlan, we're better off in terms of fairer getting both sides, though there's still a lot of problems. Of course, compared to a good, solid Australian correspondent who's solid, like the guy before Edel Lachlan at the Fairfax papers was a guy named Ross Dunn. He was fine. He offered solid things. You often get some people from American papers. You sometimes see Isabel Kirshner appearing from the New York Times or the other New York Times people. That's up and down. Isabel Kirshner is good. The other New York Times correspondent whose name escapes me at the moment. It's a mixed bag, and there's much less ability to, at the time, I think the Jewish community here, including AJAC where I work, was able to sort of try and complain to the editors, you know, ask them to edit better what was being sent to them from their correspondents in the Middle East. And there have been some correspondents also from The Australian who were I think, caused problems. Don Lyons, the obvious argument, he's a bit later than this article, now at the ABC. You could ask them to edit or guide their journalists a bit more. And I think that's not, now what we're using, just people are just picking stuff out of foreign media or wire services. We have very little control in Australia how the newspaper articles are slanted. On the other hand, of course, people are less reliant on that for news than they once were. Overall, I think while there are still problems with some of the papers, in some extent it's improved because we don't have the very worst. The other thing I would say is that there's an exception to that. The one thing I would say is you used to have a lot of the problem with particularly the Fairfax papers and the Canberra Times using a lot of Guardian and Independent. Now, The Guardian is a very slanted paper on Israel. It has a strong editorial line against Israel, and some of its stuff is pretty indefensible, frankly. That stopped. That's good. However, there's a reason it stopped, and the reason is The Guardian is now here. They're not a printed paper, but they're online, and they're very heavily used as a news source. They're one of the top news sources, top five news sources in the country, and that's in itself very problematic. People who see that paper, who use that paper as a major news source, and some of their, even some of their local reporting is very dubious, are going to get a very, very slanted view compared to the nine papers, which tend to lean more left and a bit more critical. It's a very mixed bag compared to what was that, 2005.
Before you leave the print media, can we make a distinction, would you say, Svi, between reportage of what's going on and opinion and commentary on what's happening?
Sure, absolutely, you should. Obviously, there's a difference, but you want reportage. You mean there's certainly obligations for reporting, which you can enforce or demand that media apply that are different for commentary. And for commentary, all you can really complain about is blatant factual errors. For reportage, you expect some balance, some professionalism, some attempt to show some background and context. That's not necessarily an obligation. When you're dealing with commentary, the commentary is, again, it's a mixed bag. We've got, some of the people in The Australian are very good. Greg Sheridan is consistently good. He writes about the Middle East a fair amount. He knows his stuff, and he understands Israel. There's some others there who are also good. Some of the other papers, I think, and I got to say, it helps that the work AJAC and others have been doing to send journalists to Israel, the New South Wales board does that as well. It makes a big difference. We've also got some very, very negative coverage occasionally from commentators who are consistently bad. I think the worst at the moment is, and that this varies over time on the print media, but the worst is Greg Barnes, who writes in the Hobart Mercury, who on a pretty much has to find a really nasty dig at Israel, and no matter what he's writing about, in virtually every column he writes, and he writes every second week. Either it's in a column about how horrible Israel is, or it's a column about something completely different, but he has to put in a line about how horrible Israel is, often with a jibe also about the power of the Jewish lobby or the Israel lobby to shut down all debate about how horrible Israel is. That's the worst of the current commentary at the moment.
I've had the pleasure of interviewing him, so I know what you're talking about, Svi.
Oh, did you?
Yes.
That would have been fun. But yes, absolutely, commentary and the standards for commentary and news reporting are different. And like I said, we have much less control, I think, for news reporting these days than we did in terms of Australians trying to talk to media editors and say, "Hey, your coverage could be better." Is much harder to do now. On the other hand, in some ways, it is better.
So you've discussed the print media. Now, if we move perhaps to radio and television, of course, in this day and age, video or television is is probably the most important media outlet because the visual element really commands an audience. And so what would you say is the landscape like when it comes to those other two media?
Yeah, I wouldn't necessarily, it's changing with that last point you made about the most important, yes and no. I think the way young people are relying heavily on social media, particularly video from social media, some of it from television, but a lot of it not, is probably even getting more important these days. Look, the television scene, we've got our same channels we had in 2005, the five free-to-air channels, now with a lot more digital in place, now with a lot more channels each, but not much difference in current affairs and news. The 7, 9, and 10, there's not a lot to say about them, except that they use overseas feeds. Sometimes it's great, sometimes it's not so great. And again, we have little input. Again, there's no local correspondence usually there. You see, we'll get back to in a second. They do have, of course, a Middle East correspondence. They're almost the only ones left in Australia. SBS has, I think, improved a lot since the time I wrote that article. There was a lot of problematic coverage on SBS at the time, and now I think their news is pretty straight. They have good coverage in the Middle East. It's the most extensive of any television outlet. Most of the time, and they interview people that some of the Jewish people in the Jewish community, including Ajak, would not be that happy with, but they also interview people we would be more happy with. I think it comes out reasonably even. So SBS deserves a pat on the back for improving a lot and being very professional and fair. 7, 9, and 10 up and down, limited coverage and basically whatever they can find.
You are currently listening to Dr. Zvi Fleischer from Ajak talking about how Israel is depicted these days in the Australian media. And we will return to the second part of my discussion with him in a moment. In the last few days, I came across a music app called Shiri, and I can hardly believe that I didn't come across it sooner, because it is a gem. The National Library in Israel, in cooperation with Israeli artists and sponsored by the Ministry of Culture and Sport, created the music app Shiri, which offers a fantastic way to listen to Israeli music. Free of charge and free of ads, the app can be downloaded from the Google Play Store or iTunes. Shiri is a music app that learns what you want to listen to and chooses similar songs for you by Israeli artists you love and even some you haven't heard of. All you have to do is choose three of your favorite Israeli artists and Shiri will take it from there. Every like will direct the app to the style and artist you like, and every dislike we'll move to the next song and let Shiri know that wasn't the right direction for you. Shiri learns and understands your taste, but unlike other apps, Shiri lets you skip over an unlimited number of songs that you don't like. What's more, if you listen to Israeli music via Shiri, Israeli artists receive more royalties than from any other app. By using Shiri, you support Israel's musicians and strengthen the country's music industry. At this stage, Shiri's interface is essentially in Hebrew, though they say that if there is enough demand from users, a future English version is a possibility. If you have a little Hebrew, you can switch the language on your smartphone to Hebrew and then seed Shiri with a couple of suggestions. Even without Hebrew, you can enter some English characters and song artist names will appear from which you can make a selection. Once you have the app going, it kind of grows of its own accord. As I've been talking, I've been playing a track from a group I came across thanks to Shiri called the Zaman Quartet, and you have been listening to a track called Blue Hand from their timeless album that was released in 2018. Let's return now to the second part of my interview with Dr. Zvi Fleischer from Ajak, talking about how Israel is depicted these days in the Australian media. We resume the discussion with the ABC, probably the main bugbear when it comes to media coverage about Israel in Australia.
ABC remains the most problematic and controversial, and of course it's very important. Not because it's the largest audience, but because it's the most influential, even if it isn't the largest audience. The average punter may not watch it, but anybody who really does politics or focuses on foreign policy in government, in media, in any area, in academia, they rely heavily on the ABC. A lot of what it does is quite good, and as I said, it's the only ones, virtually the only ones in Australia left with dedicated correspondents. It's unfortunately, it's a a mixed bag. What it doesn't, one thing I think that we can say definitely about the ABC is it has a tendency, very strong tendency to have these journalistic narrative frames very heavily shape the, particularly the coverage, particularly the one about the victims and the victimizer and the Palestinian case being the most important and the cycle of violence and all that. How will this affect anything happening in Israel? How will this affect the peace prospects? News on television is, it's usually mostly okay with some serious problems occasionally. But one thing it doesn't have, which even in 2005 it didn't, but it did until I think 2003, it has no independent complaints procedure. The ABC used to have an external complaints procedure called ICRAP, the Independent Complaints Review Panel, which the ABC, I think in 2002 or 2003, I could be wrong about the year, unilaterally decided to get rid of. They said they had a consultation process, but they basically told very few people about it and knew they were going to get rid of it no matter what people said. And that was a huge loss to a public broadcaster. ABC, as I said, does some good work, but it needs to have an independent means of verifying it. At the moment, they say they have an independent complaint department, but it isn't independent. It's under the same umbrella as all the news departments. They answer to the board and to the director. If the director says, you will find this way in response to a complaint, they have no ability to say, no, we won't. So it's not independent in any shape or form. That's the most important thing to deal with the ABC's seriously problematic coverage areas. Some of the worst, ABC has had a fairly poor track record on shows like Q&A, which was had a fairly unwillingness to hear mainstream Israeli points of view most of the time, or his mainstream Jewish points of view, and had an audience that was terribly hostile. And I think they had some producers there who had some of these very strong biases. So that, I think we're seeing this year whether it might have changed a little bit under the new scheme with Hamish McDonald as the new host, but we're still watching that closely. But some of the areas on radio on the ABC, and I think without dealing with commercial radio, obviously music isn't of interest. The talk shows, commercial talk shows, again, it's a mixed bag, but mostly all of them depend on overseas, you know, wire services for their news coverage, and they just sort of repeat them. Some of the commentators are good, some of them are less good, but no, it's a mixed bag. The ABC has some big problems, I think, in radio. One is religion and ethics, I think, is a particularly problematic program on Radio National. They have a tendency to find any anti-Zionist, particularly an anti-Zionist Jew, they particularly love those. Very extreme sorts of views featured there. I think there's some people who work there who are very fascinated with anti-Zionism, essentially. Or I don't know if they're being contrary or what, but they're very problematic. They will run occasionally people the Jewish community would like, but it's a minority. And they will seize, it's also interesting to note that if you follow ABC coverage, not only on radio, but more particularly on radio, but also to some extent on TV, any sort of spokesperson or, it's not this year obviously, but in the past that the Palestinian lobby in Australia, APAN or a Friends of Palestine would bring out here, would get a very extensive run on ABC programs. And if you have something comparable, much more so, than say someone brought out by Jewish groups. Even someone with a very big reputation would get, you know, one or two appearances in the ABC, and then a Palestinian spokesperson would get five appearances on the ABC on five different programs, two television and three radio across different networks and different time slots. That's clearly shows a wider, deeper problem at the ABC that I think is very much cultural. I think the ABC has a culture of the Palestinians are the oppressed ones. And I think this theme that goes back to the Soviets and the Soviet leftism, which was spread to the wider left in the 60s and 70s, the Palestinians are the most oppressed people in the world, and then Israel is the linchpin of imperialism. It's the most important, serious problem in the world. It's still, the things they learned in university are still dominating the coverage a lot. Another very problematic area, of course, is the ABC, which doesn't have even approaching reasonable parity, is Late Night Live with Philip Adams. And I think Philip Adams lets his own prejudices dominate what he wants. He's also very interested in anti-Zionist Jews or Palestinian spokespeople, authors writing pro-Palestinian books. He has to interview them all. He occasionally will have a a mainstream pro-Israeli point of view as balanced, but it doesn't come even close to half-half. That's another one. It's very difficult to, AJAC, where I work, does complaints about some of this. With the complaint procedure the way it is, it's very hard to win on anything but the sort of direct factual errors. And even, I wanted to point out one more thing about electronic media with the ABC. Even someone who does a reasonably good job of balance, like Geraldine Doug, who has a Radio National show, I think on Saturday.
So I wanted to mention her, yes.
She does a fairly good job. She runs pro-Israel people as well as people critical of Israel or pro-Palestinian people a lot of the time. But there was an incident, I think, 2 years ago where really even her, she did a story with two Israeli experts on water, talking about water technology and water conservation technology. And they talked about it, and that was fine. And then to balance it, she was told that she had another segment where she said, well, to balance it, we had another expert on water to see the people complain. We didn't get the Palestinian perspective that Israel's stealing all the water, essentially. That wasn't her words, but that was essentially the complaint. So she had another neutral expert from America, not Israeli, not Jewish, but sort of giving a reasonable discussion of the sides. I don't remember the name of the expert, but someone from Brookings or a similar American think tank. That was fine. And then the week after that, she had an apology for not giving the Palestinian perspective. A week or two afterwards, this all took place over a few weeks, apologizing, saying she had let them down by not having the Palestinian perspective, and had on two Palestinian or pro-Palestinian perspectives saying how Israel is stealing all the water. They would never do that if it was the other way. If they give a Palestinian perspective, they would never apologize and then an Israeli perspective and then a Palestinian perspective and then put on an Israeli. It doesn't work that way. It's only that the Palestinians are victims. They must be catered to. They must be given prominence. They must have their voices heard everywhere and anywhere. I think that's a widespread mindset at the ABC. And it spreads even to someone like a fairly good, solid journalist and commentator like Geraldine Doug. So I think the ABC has some cultural problems, and I think management needs to deal with it, but I also think a complaints procedure is a big part of the answer, because the moment the complaints procedure is a bit of a joke, they seem to, if you complain about something, even something that seems like a factual error, they essentially go back to the program who made this alleged factual error or error, and then they give you back whatever that program, if the program agrees it's a mistake, okay, they agree it's a mistake. If they don't agree it's a mistake, well, they will give back to the complainant whatever the program said, and we'll find the language of the ABC editorial code of conduct is very vague. They will find a way to argue, well, this is within the code of conduct. It's opinion, we're allowed to say opinion, or some people say that this fact is true. Here is a source that says this fact is true, even though it's not, even though it's overwhelmingly not true. Here is a source that says it's true, even though it's a fringe source. Anything like that. I think the ABC has some serious problems. I think there has been some areas of improvement since 2005, but it's still a very problematic area.
Yeah, just before we leave the ABC and perhaps talk about the complaints process in more detail, I must say that I follow the ABC very closely. This water issue was something that I got involved with and started a campaign on social media with the hashtag TellOurABC, and I tried to circulate that and try and get as many people as possible to get the message across as to what they had done with this water issue, did programs on it. And that issue never goes away. The issue of water is one that always seems to bubble to the surface. But with this issue that just came up recently, where Geraldine Doug took up the normalisation that just happened between Israel, Bahrain, and the United Arab Emirates, she first spoke to some fairly reputable journalists to get an assessment of it. And then she gave the impression that there were a horde of pro-Palestinian activists that would have been listening to the program, that would have been hammering very hard to get a pro-Palestinian perspective put up. And that's what happened the next week. And we got Khalidi from Columbia University, who at least gave a reasonable perspective. But I had texted the program in the meantime and said, please don't get somebody who's just going to echo the same old sentiments that we hear all the time from the rejectionist pro-Palestinian camp. And of course, we got one of them. We got Diane Boutu, who just says just the sort of stuff that we keep hearing time and time again. But the other thing I also wanted to mention before we leave comments you were just making was Q&A. There may be indications that Q&A is on a different tack. There was a Q&A just a couple of weeks ago dealing with the American elections, and they did have people on that panel who seemed to be fairly well divided, and it wasn't a case of another case of the Trump derangement syndrome being trotted out, people on the ABC. So there may be some signs that things are changing. Let's hope.
It's hard to tell with Q&A this year because it's been a very weird year. Everything's been very changed. I'm talking about COVID and all the lockdown related issues all the time. It is true that there's been definitely a change of both Comhair and of the producers at the Q&A. So far, we haven't seen a lot to complain about, and unlike in past years. So we're hopeful, but it's hard to say until things get a little more normal and the coverage becomes to more normal than the sorts of things that have been going, things that have been going on this very weird year. I don't doubt that that's part of the issue with the journalists at the ABC. They come under heavy Palestinian pressure, and while they feel that they have to listen to Palestinian pressure or Palestinian complaints, in a way that if a member of the Jewish community complains, they're more likely to dismiss. They feel they have to meet their needs. That's part of this intersectionality or postmodernist, or they're seen as a version of multiculturalism, which says these people are deprived, they're lack of voice, and therefore it's our job to give them one in a way that they don't feel about the Jewish community, even though I don't think that's a valid claim to make.
So on the question of complaints, I have been involved in doing that, and of course AJAC has been very prominent as well in that arena. Perhaps you can tell us how AJAC looks at the question of complaints. I know that because of the pushback that you get and other organisations as well, I know speaking to the Executive Council of Australian Jury, you also issue complaints from time to time, that there's a sense of frustration and hopelessness about the complaints process and where it gets us. So how do you feel, where does AJAC stand at the moment when it comes to raising complaints?
As I said before, I think we're very concerned that the complaints procedure is not working, that it's not independent, it serves the ABC's agenda. The code of conduct is vague and can be interpreted in different ways, and they are very creative in finding ways to interpret it. The complaints department or the audience and consumer affairs department, when they don't want to uphold the complaint, they're very creative in finding ways to argue that a complaint is not upheld, even though it seems to, on the face of it, violate the code of conduct. The system seems to be that a lot of the time, that the way complaints seem to work is the Audience Consumer Affairs Department basically sends the complaint back to the program concerned. If the program concerned wants to concede an error, then the complaints procedure, the Audience Consumer Affairs concedes the error. If they don't, they don't. They find a way to argue that the program was justified in what they did. Whatever justification the program itself offers, they just pass back to the consumer a lot of the time, and they won't interfere with that. That's effectively allowing the programs to police themselves, the comparison programs to police themselves. We do win on occasional things, but usually it's got to be very clear-cut, and it's basically we win when a sensible journalist decides to concede that they made a mistake. And, journalists make mistakes. If we're making a complaint, doesn't mean we're saying you're a raving anti-Semite or you're a horrible journalist. We're saying you made a mistake and you should correct it. A lot of ABC journalists, unfortunately, are, in general, reluctant to concede that they could have made a mistake or concede error. They feel, for whatever reason, under threat, or if you complain about them, your independent media is not being, they can't be independent if they respond to anyone's complaints or criticisms. So you don't get a lot of complaints upheld because, as I said, the way it works a lot of the time, and I guess there are exceptions, I have seen some, where the consumer affairs will overrule the program or the journalist involved. A lot of times you just get back whatever the journalist decides to concede. But the solution to all of this is we need an independent body of experienced journalists, which is what ICRAP was. It was a panel of journalists you could appeal to review your complaint if the ABC tossed it, which they likely would. We know that the ABC upheld very few complaints of the number they get. They report on that. That itself, it tells you something. They'll tell you it means, oh, we're so good that none of the complaints that are against us are justified, but that's not, I don't think that's the obvious conclusion to draw. Now, there is, you can appeal from the ABC complaints procedure to the communications ombudsman, communications thing, but that's not really a valid way to go. It's not a substitute for an independent complaints procedure. They're not really there to investigate factual issues or things. They're not really equipped to do that well.
You're talking about ACMA, aren't you? Is that
ACMA? Yeah. They're not really equipped to deal with the ABC complaints about the ABC violating its code of conduct. They're much more to deal with technical violations. You know, are people obeying the spectrum rules and obeying rules about obscenity, perhaps? They're not really equipped to investigate complicated issues of politics and whether things are factually accurate and whether interpretations offered are reasonable. So that's not a solution, as the ABC sometimes argues. ICRAP, the advantage of it was journalists, working journalists who knew what they were doing, who had experience, and obviously not all complaints to the ABC necessarily go to them. The ABC decision to get rid of that was one of the biggest setbacks in public broadcasting in the last couple of decades. Fortunate one that needs to be reversed.
So is AJAC lobbying for that to happen?
We are. We've been pushing Parliament, et cetera, to consider push the ABC to do that. I think we've got some friends in Parliament who are prepared to listen to us, but we haven't broken through yet. But we are certainly demanding an independent complaints procedure related to the ABC.
As we're speaking, it's important to make a distinction, though, between the ABC and the other media, because the ABC does have a charter that it's supposed to follow, but other media is essentially independent. It can go its own way, although there are certain rules that need to be followed in terms of factual reporting. And when it comes to, say, something that comes out in the Fairfax media, if you don't like it, you do have a course of complaint that can take you to the Press Council. Is that worthwhile to pursue complaints with those other media, taking them to the Press Council?
Occasionally. Press Council is also not the best thing in the world, but again, there's a difference. As you say, the ABC is not the same as Fairfax Media, or a for-profit media. They have, to some extent, the right to be biased or unprofessional if they want to be. The ABC does not have that right. They're paid for by the taxpayer to provide a professional news service. They don't have the right to do that, to be unprofessional or unbalanced, unfair, and to essentially take sides into political debates. But they do. There's an attitude, actually, among at least some ABC journalists and some ABC supporters, that the ABC is there not to provide professional journalism, but to provide alternative journalism. That is, we are here to provide views different to the capitalist media that you see elsewhere. And I don't think that's defensible. If you put that to the Australian people, we're going to have a media outlet that's going to be a left-wing outlet to provide an alternative to commercial media. I can't imagine that the majority of Australian people would say that. Let's all give them money. If they want to be a taxpayer-funded broadcast arm of Green Left Weekly, which some ABC journalists or ABC supporters do, then they need to fund that privately. You can't expect the Australian taxpayers to fund a fringe political organization providing media, even if that's what you would like. No one's going to sustain that. That's essentially a bait and switch. We're going to have a professional media, and then we're going to get what we're going to use it to do what we want with it. That's not defensible. However, newspapers generally do accept an obligation to listen to their readers, and you can take it to the Press Council if you want to. Press Council, I don't have the best experiences with, but sometimes you win. But they tend to also be very broad in opinion, even if you have they're willing to settle for if you have a source that says what you said, or if what you said had a source at the time but later turned to be incorrect. They don't feel you. They often have said you don't have to make a correction, even if what you said was wrong, if you had a good reason to believe it at the time, even if you never reported the actual factual things later. That's happened before. That seems ridiculous. The point of a complaint that something was factually incorrect is not to say the journalist did something bad. Maybe they didn't. Maybe they acted in good faith from the source they had. The point is to get facts out there, the correct facts. And if you get something wrong, even if you acted in good faith, the obligation is to either correct it or at least report the actual factual thing later. That happens a lot, that things are wrong interpretations or wrong understandings or wrong facts are reported. They turn out to be wrong. The correct facts never come out later. Even if it was defensible at the time to report what you knew, that's happened a lot with Israel. It happened with the Mavi Mara Mara case back in 2010 with the Turkish ship. There was a lot of issues that where a lot of stuff came out later, which was never reported at the time, which was incorrectly reported at the time and never came out later in the Australian media. You could find it if you went overseas to overseas media and looked for it, but if you were reading the newspaper or you were following the ABC, you would never know it. That sort of thing happens with the press council as well. Again, I think it's based on a wrong understanding. The point of a complaint is not to say the journalist did something bad or was unprofessional. The purpose thing is to say there's a factual error here that needs to be corrected. It should be corrected. First obligation is to tell the facts as best known. And if you get it wrong, even from good motives or based on good sources, it's an obligation to get to put the good facts out there. It's reasonable that the standards for commercial media are different than for the taxpayer funded ABC.
Yeah, I'd like to mention a practical example that I'm currently running with, and it was very good to see your colleague at AJAC also produce an article about the one that came out by Andrew Jackson in The Age and Sydney Morning Herald now about a month ago. Now, that article of hers, as you well know, is riddled with errors, of which would be tantamount to lies and misinformation. Certainly, she's very low on facts. And the article I wrote that ended up in The Spectator and the one that Aaron Shapiro wrote that is on the AJAC website in the Fresh Air section also went through it in great detail. Now, my complaint sitting with the press council, I don't know whether AJAC followed it up as well, but I'm keen to see what will be the result of that. I've been going to and fro with the features editor at The Age, Maha Magrabi, over this. I've provided him with a pile of information that tackled one particular fact, which is a pretty important one and obviously used by pro-Palestinian activists, which is the fact about what the population in the Jordan Valley was pre-1967, because they would like to use the fact that the numbers there now are much less than they supposedly were back pre-1967 to suggest that Israel follows a policy of ethnic cleansing. If we can undermine this sort of narrative that they put out, we can gain something. But at the end of the day, even if we win over something like this, Svi, isn't it largely a Pyrrhic victory? We might get an excuse or an acknowledgement that they were wrong, but nobody will hear about it. The damage has already been done.
Well, that's always a danger with any complaint. The dangerous damage is always done, and that happens at the ABC too. If you win, even if it were the ABC or SPS, you win a complaint. Sometimes they put some correction on the website that if you go back and happen to look at the story, you'll find that there was a correction there. Sometimes it's sort of buried on a report somewhere on the ABC website that they upheld a complaint about something. So it's very hard to find out that something was wrong. That's often a problem to us, often to publicize when they got something wrong and they've agreed, because they won't. For a public broadcaster, that is pretty unacceptable. You get something wrong, it should be up to you to make sure people know the correct information and that the corrections are prominent. Andrew Jackson, yes, that was a real classic article of terrible journalism. Jackson went to a Palestinian activist she had met in the West Bank, and she just published everything he said. She's put some of it in that he has claims, that ridiculous claims as facts, such as that there were 325,000 or whatever it was, Palestinians living in the Jordan Valley when Israel conquered it in 67, which is absolutely not true, out by at least five times. There was more like 50,000 or 60,000.
There's one particular incident I want to run past you, Svi, and it relates to your executive director, Colin Rubenstein. He will find himself defending a defamation claim, I believe, next month, being raised by Melissa Park. The News Limited actually issued an apology to her, although they said that they weren't necessarily accepting that any of the comments they made were imputations against her. They still accepted there was no truth in any of them, and they apologised to Melissa Park if readers inferred that there was anything being said of her that insinuated that she had made anti-Semitic remarks. Do you see this as being a fear by media that basically makes a bit reluctant to go out there and say things because they're getting intimidated by people like Melissa Park who scare them into finding themselves in court cases that can be protracted and waste a lot of time and expense?
Look, I hate to be a problem here, David, but I really can't talk about this. As you say, we're in the middle of litigation on this. I've been told I can't say anything about the case or anything related to the case.
So even historically, the attitude of media on dealing with Melissa Park, their apology, you can't even comment on that?
I don't think I should. We've been advised by our lawyers not to say anything about anything related to the case.
All right. Anyway, the case is going to court, I understand, and as we both know, Dave Sharma is also involved in the case. It's been really most interesting to be discussing the subject, which is one close to my heart indeed, Svi, and certainly to yours as well. I appreciate the amount of time that you've spent with me today on the Israel Connection. I thank you for your efforts to deal with issues concerning the media.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
On today's program, you've been listening to Dr. Svi Fleischer from AJAC in conversation with me about how Israel is depicted these days in the Australian media. You can go to the JAF website, which is about to be reborn, and there you can download the full podcast of my interview with Svi Fleischer, which includes another 10 minutes or so in which we sum up the analysis of how Israel is dealt with by the media in Australia. As from tomorrow, JAF will be broadcasting on its new FM frequency of 88.0, which will extend our coverage to encompass a much wider net of the Jewish community living in Caulfield and the surrounding suburbs. Please join with us in celebrating this significant milestone in the life of JAF and support what we are achieving by becoming a member. Go to our new website and join up. It only costs $54 per annum and will help us keep broadcasting 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Until next week, it's goodbye from the Israel Connection.
The Israel Connection was proudly sponsored by the United Israel Appeal.